dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Those of you who are regular listeners, I think, have come to expect a lot of intelligence and intelligent interlocutors in this program. I think you're going to be especially impressed by the one that we have with us today for, I'm very pleased to say, the full hour. His name is Professor Michael Richtenwald. He is a former professor of liberal studies at New York University and has been writing, it's some extremely impressive works, including most recently a novel that has just come out entitled Thought Criminal. We're going to be talking to him about that. But his vision for what is going on in the woke culture and the effort to enforce upon us all conformity with it is a subject that is, I believe, in urgent need of attention. And he is giving it to it, and he will give it to us. And I'm very pleased to have him with us. Professor, thank you for taking time to visit with us today and for all that you're doing to really raise the alarm about what is afoot and what it means for all of us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be speaking to you.
Let's start, perhaps, in this first block with a little bit of your own personal history, because it really informs your writing, both fiction and nonfiction, including the Google Archipelago, which we'll be talking about in due course. You ran afoul of the woke culture, I think it's fair to say. You started out on their side. Is that also fair?
Well, it would be fair to say that I was a far leftist. Indeed, I was a Marxist for many years and ran afoul of the social justice crowd when I criticized them in a student newspaper. And from there, everything unraveled for me academically, but it opened up this whole new vista for writing, and which, you know, I've done since 2018 now. I've got four books out on basically wokeness and what's happening in terms of what it's being implemented for, what its connection is to the social and economic order that is underway or being brought in as we speak.
So how did you go from being a Marxist to someone who had the independence of thought and the courage, for that matter, to take on the fraternity of which you were obviously a distinguished member for many years, and find yourself breaking with them over such a fundamental tenet as so-called social justice?
Well, yeah. I mean, in 2016, in the fall, with the coming election of Donald Trump, the political contest between Trump and Hillary Clinton. Just at that moment, I was interviewed by the student newspaper at NYU, and I came out as myself. I had been tweeting anonymously as the anti-PC NYU prof, and got quite a bit of attention because here was an NYU professor criticizing social justice activities and ideology that was spreading on campuses. And so this student newspaper reporter wanted to know, are you really an NYU professor? And if so, could we possibly interview you? Because what you're saying is fascinating for someone coming from the inside of NYU and criticizing social justice. I was criticizing the bias reporting hotlines that had been instituted, the institution of safe spaces, the prevalence of trigger warnings on syllabi, and the no platforming or deplatforming of speakers who had anything different to say other than what the social justice left wanted to hear. And within 2 days of that interview breaking, all hell broke loose for me. I was called into the dean's office for a meeting at which the head of human resources was also present, unbeknownst to me. They were introduced after the meeting was set up and strong-armed into taking a leave of absence. Unbeknownst to me, at the same time, a committee called the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Group had issued a condemnation of me in the student newspaper as a response to my interview. And before you know it, within minutes, I was basically being ushered off of campus and condemned politically and in every other way, personally and health-wise, and then, you know, basically run off of the campus into a leave of absence.
I guess you were lucky not to have been stoned on the spot, but it sounds as though everything short of that.
I couldn't believe that what I was criticizing were institutional developments, nothing about any groups or races or genders or anything. I was criticizing these institutional developments, these mechanisms that they were employing, which I thought really started to scare me. They resembled to me a kind of totalitarianism on the march, a kind of surveillance state. And I saw it as a very pernicious development. And so I couldn't keep quiet about it anymore. And by the way, at this time that I was making these criticisms, I was still considered myself a Marxist.
But that's what I'm just trying to get my head around, Professor Michael Richtenwald, is that I thought kind of fundamental to Marxism was a recognition of the importance of conformity, of the collective as having higher wisdom and, you know, greater importance than the individual, and that this would be kind of a fundamental breach of, well, I guess you might call it the social contract with Marxism, would it not, to be sort of free thinking and standing up and saying, wait a minute, this is totalitarianism and I don't want to be part of it.
Yes, I mean, but it wouldn't be that dissimilar from what happened in the Soviet Union, for example, when people that even had been socialists, you know, usually from a different party than the Bolsheviks, for example, began to criticize what was happening in the Soviet Union after the Bolsheviks' revolution. They didn't like the all of a sudden the totalitarian takeover of the state and so forth.
Yeah, it didn't end well for Trotsky, that's for sure. But so did you kind of see this as a continuation of your sort of Marxist tenets, or were you really forced into breaking with all of that by the way you were sort of driven out of campus and obviously the community?
Yes, I mean, I saw it at first as consistent with Marxism, because part of what I was criticizing was the identity politics, the emphasis on speech codes, and the emphasis on you know, wokeness and what is now called wokeness. It wasn't really that afoot at that time, but what we'd now consider wokeness. But I thought that I was seeing it from a point of view that was consistent with class politics, and that it was divisive and interrupting the agenda of class politics. And but after I...
Hold the thought, Professor. We have to come back to more on this. And I want to introduce your, I guess it's being called, dystopian novel, Thought Criminal, which sounds an awful lot like what you were experiencing at NYU and what may be in store for all of us. We'll be right back with more with Professor Michael Richtenwald right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for the continuation of an hour-long conversation with an extraordinarily thoughtful man. There's an old expression about conservatives being liberals who were mugged by reality. And if that's a truism, I think it applies in spades to Professor Richtenwald, who has just professed to having been a Marxist on campus, hardly unusual, in fact, but a man who is unusual in the sense that he broke with all of that. And we're just discussing how that came about. So, Professor, you were describing a little bit how you thought you were acting in a manner consistent with Marxist teaching about class warfare and divisions and so on. And yet you found yourself at the losing end of a viciously vindictive purge, I would guess, of, well, sort of Stalinesque dimensions, did you not?
Absolutely. And when indeed I saw the Stalinesque character of the woke crowd, the social justice warriors in my faculty, and basically also in the administration, I mean, this was pretty clear that the administration stood behind this social justice creed, and they weren't going to allow any, you know, any kind of violations of it. So I had inadvertently touched the third rail, if you will, to use the political metaphor, and unknowingly committed a thought crime. And the way that they emerged, and the way that they treated me, and the, you know, the purge that they conducted really opened my eyes to my whole political creed, and I had to split from it. I had to denounce it entirely, because I saw what it really was, what it was like in real time as it manifested itself.
Yeah, this has, it seems, inspired a novel, but one that I have to tell you strikes me as not so far removed from the present reality, especially if, you know, present trends continue unabated. Talk a little bit about thought criminal and thought deviationism, as you described it, as part and parcel of what you yourself experienced.
Well, let me just give you the premise of the novel. I also had worked in artificial intelligence at Carnegie Mellon in the Robotics Institute, so I was pretty versed in artificial intelligence and so forth. But with the onset of the virus in, you know, March, or when it became, you know, a rage, by April, I decided to address this, but I wanted to do so through fiction, because I wanted to have some things to say that I couldn't say in nonfiction prose, because it would just discredit me. And instead, I wanted to just put people into a fictive setting and situation, and sort of put some of the same factors that were playing out into a future scenario, and to see whether where this thought experiment would go. And so the premise of the novel is that there's this overarching database processing system and database and control system called Collective Mind. And there's a virus, but the virus is actually nanorobots that attach themselves to the neurons of the neocortex, and then conduct information flows between the individual and collective mind, and as such, effectively preempt the individual thinking of the subject. And so that's the premise, that's the setup of the novel. There's a character, he's a professor, and there's, you know, you can certainly read into that all you will. He's a professor, but he's a professor of AI and theory of mind at a university called Transhuman University, or TransU for short. And he is very suspicious of this virus, and he has a theory about why he thinks it's actually being propagated by the state in order to connect people with collective mind, while they're telling people that they're trying to actually to stem the spread of the virus. They're actually spreading it.
A good friend of ours and often a guest on this program, Ken Timmerman, gave you, I think, a very high compliment. He called it your book, The 1984 of the COVID Age. And that seems apt, because you really have projected in a way that kind of updates Orwell, I guess, not to take anything away from your creativity, but it certainly gives us a sense of the face and ominous power of totalitarianism in the information age, I guess one might call it. And that's chilling and fascinating that you have these various personal, you know, credentials and experiences that enable you to really credibly portray all this, whether it's the, you know, artificial intelligence dimension, or whether it's the totalitarian ideological component, or whether it's the personal experience of being canceled, as they say these days. And what would be the message of this book in terms of what we do about this? Because I want to turn in the next segment with you, Professor, to what we're actually watching play out now all around us. And I hope that, I confess, I have not had a chance to read the book. I've skimmed parts of it. But is there hope for mankind and the individual, let alone a country like ours, in the kind of sort of gathering storm, I guess one might call it, that you've portrayed in Thought Criminal?
Well, yes, I think there is. And let's just say that the novel, unlike 1984, where Winston effectively falls in love with Big Brother, the hero of this novel, who is deemed a thought deviationist, a vaccine resistor, and a banned researcher, three strikes, and he's out. He is a resistor to this, and he is trying desperately to maintain his individual selfhood in the face of this overwhelming technological, ideological, and political enemy, really, collective mind. And he bands together with a network of deviationists who effectively are able to thwart the effects of this. What makes our country, what makes it possible is not only the Constitution and a Bill of Rights, but a long history and tradition that ties into individual liberty that wasn't available for those who underwent the Soviet Revolution or the Chinese Revolution or any of the other communist revolutions in the world.
We have that going for us. But the question to which we will turn here momentarily is, do we have enough of it left to have essentially imprinted? So just to stay again with the novel and the picture it portrays, would you say that wokeness and the kind of totalitarian practices and you know, dictates of the academy that you personally experienced are really but steps away from the kind of, hyper-technologically driven restrictions and domination, but basically inexorably lead you in that direction, especially when it is combined with what big tech is bringing to bear?
Yes, that's why I think that the response to me in the academy is so strong, because I had really touched a nerve that was central to basically a whole socio-political agenda that was just that was germinated in the academy, but was then metastasizing to the rest of the social body and was now part of the social order that was being established. This was so that I see wokeness not merely as some sort of aberration that stemmed from the academy and, you know, that a few people have adopted outside of it, but rather as part of the ideological hegemony that's being unleashed, and being spread, and that has a certain function in the social order. And I can talk about that function if you'd like.
Well, I definitely want to come to that, because I think this is the heart of the challenge that we're facing is, do we, like you, have to have some rude awakening to appreciate how far advanced this phenomenon is? You use the term metastasize, and I think that's so apt. Or, you know, is it something that, short of, you know, a calamitous well, mugging by reality, we will be able to come to grips with. And Professor, as we're sort of noodling this again in connection perhaps with some of the other books that you've written as sort of the prelude to Thought Criminal, you can introduce us to some of these other warning signs, indicators and warning is what the military calls them, of a very unhappy future for us. I just want to say, it is so heartening to hear someone who has come, well, they would say in the espionage world, in from the cold, has this capacity to both grapple with what is afoot and share it so vividly with the rest of us. So I commend you for that, and it's why I was so anxious to have a chance for a proper chat with you, which will continue. After just a short break, we'll be speaking with Professor Michael Rechtenwald about both the implications of thought criminality for all of us, and what are the signs that we best be taking to heart and responding immediately to in our own time. That and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. This is the third installment of our very important conversation. If you're just tuning in, I hope that you'll go to the podcast at Secure Freedom Radio. It is really important groundwork to what we'll be talking about in these next two blocks with Professor Michael Rechtenwald, formerly a Marxist, self-professed Marxist professor of liberal studies at New York University, and now an extraordinarily clear-eyed critic. And, alarm raiser about the threats that we now face in contemporary America as a result of what has emerged from the academy in the form of rampant totalitarianism. Michael Rechtenwald, again, thank you for your time today, and thank you for teeing up some of the things that I was anxious to specifically address with you about our own time. Let's start with China. You touched on it a moment ago. China has emerged, I think, indisputably as the greatest existential threat to freedom in the world, in arguably its history. One facet of which is the use of technology to control most immediately its own population, something called the social credit system, but clearly now intended, especially when they marry it up with data about, you know, healthcare and diseases and the like, as an instrument of thought control, perhaps, but more to the point, comprehensive control of individuals, not just in China, but around the world. If you share that view, please help me articulate it better, because it's chilling.
Okay, well, I mean, some of the symptoms before we go into the connection with China include, of course, what I call big digital and their propagation of propaganda, their squelching or utterly arresting of expression that differs from their own from their own perspectives, the unmitigated disappearing of dissidents, if you will, from the digital realm, and a kind of digital gulag, as I call it, a kind of that's why I named the book Google Archipelago. As such, I meant to suggest a parallelism between the gulag archipelago and the digital archipelago that we're now dealing with. And this extends to also the kind of 5G-enabled surveillance smart cities that are in full force in China and under development in the U.S., which will implement the effective equivalent of the social credit scoring system, probably under the pretense of the arresting of the virus, where its permutations, as we're probably going to have, there's probably going to be a COVID 20, 20, 20.1, 20.2, 20.3, et cetera. I mean, I fully expect this mutation to increase the pretense for using this virus and its mutations for a kind of social credit scoring that will vastly reduce individual liberty in terms of mobility. They've already instituted in terms of speech, freedom of association, freedom of religion, and possibly even extending to the imprisonment of political dissidents.
Let me just interrupt, because I think, again, this is not a hypothetical or a distant prospect. This is at hand, at least with respect to this idea that you're not going to be able to get on a plane unless your phone is going to document that you have been vaccinated. I mean, this is happening now in China. Qantas has just adopted it. It's seemingly going to be adopted by other air carriers, among other, you know, businesses, presumably. Talk a little bit about how that plays into this sort of social credit system that you've described as having so many implications for freedoms that we find fundamental and God-given, by the matter.
Sure, yeah. So the social credit score, just for those who maybe aren't completely up to date on this, is a means by which China controls its population in terms of travel, in terms of ownership of property, in terms of attendance at certain schools for their children, in terms of owning a home, in terms of everything, really. And the social credit score should really be understood as a socio-political credit score. It also extends to your political views. So this...
In a way, I would argue that that's really the first order of business for the Chinese Communist Party, isn't it?
Absolutely. So this virus and its mutations will be a pretense for instituting the equivalent of this social credit score, because it'll indicate compliance with the regime under formation and or the lack thereof. And it could be used, and it will, I think, be used to restrict and repress the population in ways very similar to what's already underway in China. And I think, and I'll just put this out there now, that China has been the model for these great resetters, if, for lack of a better phrase, that's their own terminology, to institute what they're calling this new kind of capitalism, which they call stakeholder capitalism. And it is really a form of state capitalism, like the Chinese capitalist system. So there's the eradication of small and mid-sized businesses, which has been undertaken under the virus responses, and this kind of consolidation of monopolization on top, and a very static hierarchy being established, a kind of neo-techno-bio-feudalism, if you will. The virus is all a piece of that.
Yeah, and we haven't talked as much as we need to about this great reset on Secure Freedom Radio to this point, so I'm very pleased to have you with us. You've done some brilliant critical analyses of it at the von Mises Institute, and I want you to develop this a little bit further, because one of the things that I've long believed is that we saw this as an impetus behind the coronavirus, if not actually its instigation by the Chinese Communist Party, then certainly the response to it there and here. Are you familiar with Event 201?
Well, not exactly. I know of Agenda 2030.
Let me just introduce this quickly, because I think it ties into all of that. But it was a tabletop exercise that was conducted back in, I believe, September of 2019. And it was sponsored by the Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum and the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Central Intelligence Agency participated in it, as did the Centers for Disease Control, both here and, wait for it, in communist China. And this exercise simulated a coronavirus pandemic and what good things could be done for it. I don't know that they used the term reset in this case, but they probably did. But at the very least, that was the idea, to get, you know, the World Health Organization and other supra-governmental, supranational entities, both more well-resourced and more powerful. And all of this seems to fit into, you know, what had then ensued. And I guess I wonder, when you look at, again, with your ideological training and background, Professor Richtenwald, when you look at the convergence between these so-called globalists on the one hand, who profess to be capitalists, albeit of a stakeholder variety, on the one hand, and the Communist Party of China on the other, as they pursue, it seems, at least immediately, the same goal, namely taking us down. How does that sort in the end, do you think?
Well, that's very interesting, and that's exactly what I've been just writing about. My next installment on the Great Reset is called Part 3, Capitalism with Chinese Characteristics. Just as a play on, of course, the Chinese nomenclature, which they use to describe their own economic system as socialism with Chinese characteristics. So the idea is that China had a socio-political communist system and then implemented capitalism in order to support it, because socialism as an economic system is just not viable. My argument is that what is happening in the West is this, that we started with a capitalist economic system, and what's being implemented is a socialist and communist ideological and political system to manage it. So this is the agenda. It's basically, we're having the same development as China had, except in reverse. They instituted socialist communism politically first, and then added capitalism. We started with capitalism, and now they're going to institute socialist political control on top of it.
Fascinating. And is there any question in your mind that where both take you is inexorably towards totalitarianism?
Absolutely no question in my mind. That's inexorably where it leads.
All right, we're going to have to take one last break. Professor Michael Richtenwald will be joining us to talk a bit about, what are we now obliged to do about the challenges that he's described in our own country, in our own time, and much more with Professor Michael Richtenwald, the author most recently of Thought Criminal, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio with Professor Michael Richtenwald, a former professor at New York University, where he was a Marxist and has now come in from the cold, as I think of it, having written 10 books, I believe it is, maybe 11, but 4 in his post-Marxist phase, and I commend him so strongly for it. We've talked a little bit about the Gulag Archipelago, about the digital gulag and the simulation of freedom. He also wrote Springtime for Snowflakes, about those college kids, social justice and postmodern parentage. Then he wrote Beyond Woke, and that is a subject, I think, for a review of a kind here at Secure Freedom Radio on another occasion soon. But we've been talking most immediately about his just published book, Thought Criminal, a novel. And I can't wait to read it myself and encourage everyone else to do the same. So, Professor, we have, I think, set the stage for what is most urgently needed beyond just a recognition of the problem we're confronting. And I commend you again for articulating it so powerfully and so clearly. But I want to get into what do we do about this. You've written about parentage. We've raised, myself included, I think a generation or two of children who have been imbued with a lack of affinity for our country, an appreciation of freedom, a sympathy even for socialism as a means of promoting equity. We've got the academy in full cry promoting Marxism and compounding that problem with the kids. And that's now manifesting itself, as you indicated, in institutions across the land. Where do we begin to try to take corrective action?
Well, if I could draw back to the novel just as a reference point. In the novel, there's a network of thought deviationists. And notice it's not a collective, it's a network. And so what I envision is a similar network of thought deviationists who maintain their individuality, maintain their free-thinking capacities, maintain their critical perspective at all costs, and continue to hold out a candle, a light in this environment in order to perhaps sway others and to also provide a beacon, you know, just a beacon for enlightenment in these, what I think is almost a medieval onset here.
Yes, you've talked about feudalism, techno-bio-feudalism, as I recall.
Right. So, I don't have, it's not a revolutionary, necessarily a revolutionary call or a call to revolution. It's a recall to what we already know, and that is that without individual property, without individual rights, without individualism, we are subject to this collectivism and its implementation through technology and other means, so ideology as well.
It's kind of a counter-revolution, isn't it? Because the revolutionaries are the ones seeking to impose this upon us. If I may draw you into, you know, the present crisis, that is the prospect that a presidential candidate who seems to be, if not revolutionary, in his own right, exactly, certain good with it, has brought in a vice presidential running mate who is all about it, and is supported by those who seek that outcome. On the one hand, and on the other, you have a man who I think is sort of epitomizes this individualism and attachment to the foundational principles of our country in Donald Trump. There are those who will say this election is over. I am not among them, frankly. But if the choice is framed that way, it's hard to overstate how momentous is the decision that is now awaiting the last few steps in this process, specifically, I suppose, the Congress's consideration of the Electoral College vote and possible further judicial action, perhaps by the Supreme Court. Your thoughts on the context in which we are addressing this topic?
Yes, I mean, you know, the context, of course, is this choice between maintaining American principles, which are broader human rights principles, and this ushering in without remission of socialist ideology, socialist and a communist political ideology, and a rulership, really.
The Great Reset.
The Great Reset. And Trump, you know, from the standpoint of these Great Resetters, he represents merely a speed bump on their way to establishing this. But I see it as a firewall that is maybe our last chance for generations to maintain or ward off this impending and really more than impending, incipient and, quite present threat.
You know, if I could go back to your experience, the virulence with which you were rejected and driven out of the university reminds me of the virulence that has been directed at Donald Trump, and I think probably for the same reasons. I mean, you, in a way, you were even worse because you were of the community. You know, you were a thought deviationist of the worst kind, I guess, because you had been formally embracing of it. But Donald Trump is a threat to it. Whether they think a speed bump or whether he is, as you think he is, and I think is and must be, a firewall, he is the impediment that must be overcome. And to that extent, Michael Rechtenwald, it should inform our thinking about this question of if there is abundant evidence, and I have no doubt about that, that this election was stolen, getting that right, making sure that we elect the person who actually won every legal vote, seems to me of surpassing importance against the backdrop you've described.
Absolutely. It's fundamentally, absolutely necessary to vindicate the voters, to represent the interests and the democratic process that was supposedly undertaken in order to select the president for the United States of America, which really for the rest of the world represents the last bastion of this liberty that we're talking about. So, you know, the unfortunate thing is that just like the academics and leftists now call me kind of a joke, they, believe it or not, they disparage my intellectual abilities and discredit my work. The same sort of, calumny has been associated with Trump so that they make it like a joke just to support this, whereas to my way of thinking, it is the most vital, needed support that we could possibly lend. And to such end, I will be speaking in Washington, D.C. On January 6th to state this importance. And even if I have to stand there with a bullhorn in the middle of a crowd who may or may not listen, I will be doing so.
Well, I think they will be listening raptly. I've been in several of those events in recent weeks, and I'm sure this will be even more attentive because you've got a fix on this, Professor Michael Rechtenwald. You have, I think, both experienced it firsthand, and I have to tell you, you know, I've been taken to task by some of these critics as well, and it the common denominator here is if they cannot defeat the actual arguments that we're making, they must silence us. They must make it, politically incorrect doesn't really begin to describe what is entailed in this canceling business. But I just commend you so much for, again, not only what you're bringing to this, and they say there's no more zealous a believer than a convert, and you seem to really exhibit zealousness, and it's so needed, so vitally urgent that we have it, and that it's shared, and that it is in effect a counterweight to the metastasizing cancer of totalitarianism, foreign and domestic. So we have to leave it at that, Professor Rechtenwald, but I hope it will not be for long and that you will come back to us frequently with updates as your analyses continue to turn and the challenges that we face continue to require our common and hopefully concerted action. Thank you for your time today, and God bless you. We'll encourage once again everyone to check out Thought Criminal Beyond Woke, Springtime for Snowflakes.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.